Yes, I should briefly apologise for this title, The Love Letters of Sigmund Freud. Now, of course, it should read The Love Letters of Marta Bernays and Sigmund Freud. The whole point of this evening and what I'm talking about is these two books, and this is the first publication of the full correspondence of Marta Bernays and Sigmund Freud during their engagement. The publications before have only been one-sided, so it completely distorted. So these letters, I should give you a brief background, because some people have read a part of this correspondence. They were first made public by Ernest Jones way back in the 1950s when he was writing the biography of Sigmund Freud. He had complete access to these letters, the engagement letters. And he was the first and he was the last to have that access. He used it mainly in a chapter on what he nicely calls the betrothal. And he used only very short extracts from a few of the letters, so it wasn't a true publication. Now, one of the results of that publication was that Ernst Freud, the son of Sigmund Freud, didn't like the image of his father portrayed in the biography and decided he would have to publish Freud's letters to make him, I think he thought he'd more human. So he published what's called the Selected Letters of Sigmund Freud that came out in 1960 and was translated into English. And in that volume you get, I think, something like 93 of these letters. But this is the vital thing, you only get Sigmund Freud's side of it. So it's a rather distorted view of love letters when you only get one angle on it. And then after that publication, about 1960, it's as if the letters disappeared from sight. No other researcher was ever allowed access to them. None of the subsequent biographers, including Peter Gay, ever had access to them. And when I started work here, I was even in doubt whether they still existed or had been locked away in some vault beneath the Library of Congress. And then in 2011, this was published by Fischer Verlag in German. And this is the first volume of what will be eventually a 5-volume series of correspondence. So it'll be the complete correspondence from 82 to 86 of their love letters. Something like 1,500, over 1,500 letters in all. And only the first 2 volumes have so far appeared. I don't know when the next are going to come out. So it's a work in progress. So here we have, each volume is 600 pages or so. You've got 1,200 pages. It's going to be 3,000 pages or so when it's finished. So it's a mass of unpublished, unknown material. And now I'll be talking about these first 2 published volumes. They're called, by the way, if you look at the title here, is Die Brautbriefe, which is the engagement letters. It's not love letters. Now, there's a difference between love letters and engagement letters, of course, because an engagement is a social or a cultural activity, so it's much more, it's love and a bit more included in it. When they first came out, one of the best critiques or best reviews of them came from a philosopher, French philosopher, historian who's died since, Jean Bollack, who is a historian of the Bernays family. And he said this can be read in cultural terms as a sort of example of Victorian courtship. He didn't say that was the complete reading, that was one aspect. And he also said, but you can read it as a novel, like a novel. And in fact, if we look at, I've got a little thing here, we look at this The second volume, the subtitle is Unser Roman in Fortsetzungen, which means Our Novel in Installments. And that's a quote from one of the letters. It's Martha calling their affair a novel in installments. Now, the word Roman, of course, also means a love affair. It's the equivalent of the English romance. So it's our romance in installments she was talking about. Now, that quote actually shows a certain degree of self-consciousness about what they're engaged in, a love affair that is also a novel. And you get this curious self-consciousness, this literary self-consciousness, recurring through the correspondence. For instance, just a couple of weeks after their engagement, Freud wrote to Martha on the 30th of June, 1882, and he begins the letter with inverted commas, and the first lines are, "In a wretched village at the foot of the Kahlenberg, called Krinzing after its sour wine, stands a simple low-roofed cottage." And it goes on in this novelistic vein, and it comes, you get a couple of lovers next to the cottage talking to each other or failing to talk to each other, and you become aware, of course, that he's giving us the story of one of his first meetings with Martha. And he ends that little passage, closing inverted commas, and says and writes, "Isn't that Dickens style, my dear Martha?" We're beginning already with literature, with literary references and intertextually, and you can go through these letters reading the references, and they go on and on, the literary references. I mean, this is a very highly educated couple, and Dickens is there right at the start. In fact, he's there even earlier, as you'll see. Now, the actual first letter of the correspondence is from Martha. And it's dated the 2nd of June, the 11th of June. Now that little walk that he'd been talking about in Dickensian style, was on the 2nd of June. And it's clear from this little Dickensian parody that they didn't say anything to each other. What he's talking about is their thoughts, what they should have said, and the letter is a sort of retrospective compensation for what they didn't say, and now he's finally telling her what he should have said. I mean, you get in these letters, as I said, only the one side has been published to date, you get in these letters a stereoscopic view of the relationship, obviously. Finally, for the first time, you get both their views of some events. For instance, I mean, I think Jones talks about Freud's first view of Martha, or when he was sort of struck by her, and he's struck by her physical grace and her self-possession, and then just to get a little mythic touch or a biblical touch in the way she's peeling an apple, you know. But here now we get Martha's first impression of Freud in a letter afterwards, and it's with a bit of tender mockery. She was impressed by the fact at this occasion that instead of sitting down and talking to her like a civilized person, he paces back and forwards in the room, throwing furious glances in her direction, and she says, like a caged lion. So these are the two views of the one event. So that is the first meeting, they didn't really say anything, and the day after that they went for a walk in the Prater, and still nothing seems to be happening between them, and whatever ideas he might have had, obviously she had no idea of his intentions at that point, this walk in the Prater. And Jones relates this in the biography. Now, I'll read Jones's account, because it's significantly wrong in many respects. A quote from, this is from the biography. On the following day, he strolled with her and her mother in the Prater and asked her so many questions about herself that when she got home, she told her younger sister Minna about it all and added, "What do you make of that?" She got a rather damping answer. "It is very kind of Herr Doctor to take so much interest in us." That supposedly is Minna's answer. And I've seen that quoted as evidence for, or as corroborating evidence for the Minna-Freud affair, that little sister Minna already had preemptive designs on Freud at that point in time. Now, I'm going on about this because Freud got it wrong, and if you go to the source, which is now published, you'll see the following account from a letter of Martha's of the 5th of July, and she says in this letter to Freud about this incident, "As soon as I got home, I told Minna about it." And this is in inverted commas. "Just imagine, he asked me this and that. What do you think of that, dear? How good of the doctor to take such an interest in us." And this is Martha, and the "us" is underlined. So obviously it has nothing to do with Minna, this quote. It is Martha quoting herself. And if it's evidence of anything, it's evidence of her self-effacing nature, or her low self-evaluation, that she didn't understand that Freud was really interested. Or it's simply her innocence and ignorance of courtship in those days. It might be even Freud's innocence as far as courtship is concerned, that he didn't make himself understood at that point. We have to go on reading this and reading levels of it. There's another reading, which is that she is writing this account for Freud. So why shouldn't she also be writing her own history or their history and making herself out more innocent than she really was? You can go on like that. These letters, they have, it's a case of writing and rewriting, interpretation, reinterpretation, misinterpretation. Now that, I can't claim credit for having spotted that. That was a footnote to a letter from the editors. So I have to say a word about the editors, who are really the A-team of Freudian scholarship. This is Ilse Gulbrichsen, it is Gerhard Fichtner and Albrecht Hirschmüller. And it's marvellously edited, and there's all sorts of extras which you do get in a well-edited book, like an anhang, an addenda at the end, and one of these bits you get at the end is a document entitled "List of Letters and Signs of Love." Now, this was something that Freud wrote just after he'd proposed, or within a week or so of the proposal. And it's a list, as it says, numbered from 1 to 18 of these letters and signs of love. And number 1 is dated the 11th of June, and it reads, "A note without heading, signed Ma to Bernays, accompanying the Philippchen cake." Now, that does need a footnote, and it gets one, to explain what that is. Philippchen is more or less sweetheart. And what it means is that it's a folk custom. Now, the day before, they'd gone for a walk outside Vienna, and they'd been picking almonds, by the look of it, and Freud had found an almond with a double kernel. And now there's this folk thing, I don't know if it's Germany and Austria, it's in Austria, and that double kernel in an almond is called a Philippchen, a sweetheart. And the custom is that if you find one of them, the person who next says, "Good morning, sweetheart," is owed a fine by the other one. So this note from Martha is accompanied by a cake, as he said in his note, and that was the tribute, the fine she had to pay for him beating her to it. So this letter, which is number 1, the first letter in the book begins, quoting, accompanying, actually this thing about saying the quotes, you better watch my hands now, because every time there's inverted commas around the quote, around a word, I'm going to do a little sign, because that's worth reading as well. It has some significance. So I'm quoting from this. Accompanying handicraft from me as debtor of Philippian tribute for the man of science to dissect. I must admit this should have been in verse, but rejoice, the respect I have for excessively sharp dissection bid my muse be silent. Therefore, in plain prose, my plea. The reality and transience of the gift should be attributed to lack of time. Now that's five, I think, sets of inverted commas around words in as many lines. So what I'm saying about self-consciousness and layers of significance is sort of designated or pointed to that. And the point here is that respect is not in inverted commas. So it's a very literary correspondence from the beginning, and in fact not just in terms of quotation and reference, in terms of their style. I should add that that first letter is accompanied, has a footnote from Martha saying she'd just received a as she was about to send it off, she received a present from Freud of David Copperfield in English. So the correspondence starts off with a literary note. And also, you note, she said, this should have been in verse. So she was intending, in fact, writing a little message in verse. And in fact, later on, she does write one or two verses of her own, and Freud does too. And in fact, the very last letter, the last published one here, is completely in a verse by Freud. It's of the new year, 1st of January 1884, and it's a new year rhyme. So the poems of Sigmund Freud are not widely known, so I'll just quote the final couplet from this. I haven't translated more, but the very final couplet, the last words in this book are, may this fooling not offend her, may she not mistake deep love, that the years will not delimit, that death only will remove. So it's fine stuff. Anyway, so as I said, at that point they haven't really got onto intimate terms, but after this sweetheart cake, things begin to move faster. Freud starts sending her roses, and in a thank you letter she sends for the roses. They're still on Z terms, not on the familiar do, on the formal Z terms at that point. But the next day, the 15th of June, he's already asking to go on to do terms. And 2 days later, on the 17th of June, Martha sends him a little note asking whether he would not like... in quotes, to take a little walk in the Prater with the lady known to him that evening. And the lady will be waiting at a familiar place if the heavens were clement. So the heavens were clement, and he proposed that evening in the Prater. And he must have known, of course, that she'd accept, because that note was more or less a declaration in itself. So they've gone from standing start to engagement in about 15 days. So this is fairly fast work. So, you know, it's passion and marzipan, assuming the almond cake was made, I don't know, all the way. It's not quite so simple as that, obviously. And we get something of the gist of what might have happened in the Prater a year later. So on the anniversary of the engagement, the 17th of June 1883, Freud writes her letter talking about this. Now, he'd been discussing the engagement with his friend Breuer, and he says, "I then told Breuer I had slipped into the engagement despite wanting to be reasonable. How I had thought that we should undergo a test period together in which we could get close enough, enough to get to know each other, but not so close as to be unable to separate with our integrity intact. And how I postponed such a relationship, how I proposed such a relationship, and you said, that's nonsense." So, we have Freud, the scientist, the believer in experiments, and we have Martha, who clearly is not a believer in experiments. And so, despite wanting to be reasonable, and he's the one who wants to be reasonable, they went ahead. But this whole thing about him wanting to have a test period does linger on, and it's one of the motifs that goes through the letters, that he comes back again and again to this idea of a test proba. And I think in the back of his mind there's always this idea of conditionality. Now, you can say that an engagement is a conditional arrangement anyway, that it's conditional on both parties sticking to it till the end. So in one sense, it had to be conditional. And this was doubly conditional in a way, because they kept it secret for another 6 months. The parents were not, this was in June, they got engaged, the parents were not told till Christmas. Now, it had leaked out among the sisters and among, but it wasn't in fact formal until 6 months later. But, as I say, this question of the conditionality of their arrangement is a constant, and it's being constantly discussed between them. What are the conditions of this relationship between them? There's passion then, and there's rationality we've got here. And in those terms, perhaps another memory of the Prater comes up, which is relevant. This is nearly 18 months into the relationship. Martha writes a letter to him, and she mentions a promise they had made in the Prater. They made this promise not to write any love letters, but only information about our life. Now, it's clear when you read these letters that they're love letters, or most of them are. So either they broke this promise immediately, or we have to understand it in some other sense. So we could understand it in the sense of they're not writing love letters in the stereotypical literary sense. They're not going to do that, you know, if you like, the Dickens thing. There's another way of looking at it. Maybe they wanted to sort of bracket off their love from their everyday lives and sort of keep it untouched, to, in a way, to preserve it. This is Cordelia's strategy, if you like. It's when, you know, the holiness of your love, you can't speak about it in the scene in King Lear, when the ugly sisters are loudly proclaiming her love, and Cordelia says, "What can Cordelia do? Love and be silent." So maybe it's that. Anyway, that mention of the promise not to write love affairs comes in a letter where Martha is apologizing to Freud for not writing intimately, or as intimately as he wanted, not writing from the heart. And this is a constant in the letters, that he is constantly asking her to write more of her feelings, to write more of from her heart. It's in effect to say everything that's in her mind, the old psychoanalytic injunction. And above all, Why? Because he needed the reassurance that she loved him. He's constantly pleading for this reassurance from her. And in a way, that was justified at the beginning, because Martha started this affair, started the engagement with two admirers still in tow. This was a man called Fritz Wahler and another called Max Meyer. They were both musicians, actually, artists, and that was dangerous for Freud, and both admirers of Martha. And he was reprimanding her for keeping this relationship with them going. And she wrote a desperate letter, in effect. This is on the 8th of July, 82. This is only 2 or 3 weeks after the engagement, in response to him. And it's written in pencil, incidentally, the editors tell us, because it was written on the Sabbath when she wasn't... Her mother was orthodox and strict and wouldn't want to see her writing, so she probably couldn't get at the pen and ink. And she is telling him, in effect, that he's unable to distinguish between two levels of attachment, that he's not making a distinction, which she was, between Herzlichkeit, which is friendliness, and Zärtlichkeit, which is attachment. So she's quite categorical that she wants to continue her Herzlichkeit, her friendliness with these people, while according to her, she set aside the affection, the Zärtlichkeit. And she is firm on that. She goes on, I'm quoting, "And you must not, you should not, forgive me, you will not root this out of me." Will underlined. Now, so already, this is 3 weeks into the engagement, you've got quite a serious head-to-head between them. Now, they make it up, of course. I mean, we know this story. They make it up. But there is, over the course of the next 4 years, a cyclical return to this suspicion and her self-defense. And what it does, it reveals a basic difference, a character difference between them. He needs to confront any disagreement head on. He has to have everything out in the open. Her nature is diplomatic. She wants compromise. She wants peace. And in fact, she can't understand his attitude. She says to him a little time after this, because he says how much it hurts him to have to say these things, that he's wounding himself, you know, it hurts me as much as it hurts you, that sort of thing. And she says to him, innocently, "Why do you always wallow in what hurts you and me too?" And wallow, it's an innocent enough question, I suppose, but its ramifications are endless and existential as far as they're concerned. You can interpret him, this wallowing, as she puts it, in his terms. It's first, it's saying that everything is up for discussion, and secondly, it's sort of pushing the boundaries of their relationship. And sometimes, quite often in fact, it looks as if he's deliberately pushing her what could be beyond endurance and risking the relationship. And in fact, right at the end, in 86, there are some letters when I'm amazed that it didn't break off then. I mean, it actually gets to the point of bitterness and hate. I mean, he's talking, he actually says, you know, how easily love is turned to hate in one letter. But that's way ahead. But it's part of this cycle, this recurrent cycle of these outbursts. But on the other hand, you have the feeling that he can read how far he can go. These are exercises in brinkmanship in the relationship, in effect, that he can divine the degree of their mutual, he knows the degree of her and his commitment, and that he can get away with it in effect. Now, this is reading in a certain amount of self-awareness here, and when it's hard to say, hard to judge, easy to get wrong, how much self-awareness of their situation a person, a character does have. And in fact, there's a nice illustration of this a little further ahead, and this is coming back to the literary thing. Freud is reading a book called A Woman in Spite of Herself by certain J. Cordy Jefferson. Not exactly a household name nowadays, but he was a Victorian novelist. And in this book, the heroine is accused of writing poisoned pen letters and is falsely imprisoned. So it's a nice dramatic plot. And Freud says of it, "At first I found similarities to you and didn't want to read on. Then the similarities disappear. I read to the end until the villain died and virtue got married. And I only grew angry about the extreme cruelty that the author, who knows how the novel will end, allows the poor heroine to suffer." Now, this is quite light-hearted. This was he's writing this in a good mood. He just received an affectionate letter from her. So he's not necessarily accusing himself at this point of tormenting her like cruel J. Cordy Jefferson. But there's this implication floating there that he is tormenting her. And in fact, it's more than an implication, because in other letters he actually says, "I know I am tormenting you." So he knows that in urging her to, in effect, go against her, all her inclinations and her character, that it is a torment. But the question you have to ask then is, what is her character? She's very young. I mean, she begins at the age of 20. And she's, like the folk song goes, she's young but she's daily growing. So she's not really a formed character at the beginning, so there's a certain instability in her responses, which is something he's testing. And they're both of them, well, she, perhaps as much as him, are sort of finding identifications, finding a way to define their relationship by literary identifications, for example. And of course, Copperfield comes in here, which she's been reading, and she says to him that she would like to be like Agnes, who is Copperfield's second wife, the one he deeply loves. But she fears that the possibility of her turning out like Dora, who is Copperfield's first wife and immature child wife. So she's hesitating between Agnes and Dora. So this is the sort of experiments in identities that she's engaging in, and in fact he does too. A little later on, in November 1883, she's reading George Brandes, his biographical sketch of John Stuart Mill. And she's speaking of her fascination with Mill's companionate marriage with Harriet Taylor Mill. So it's obviously seeing that as a sort of model, and she has a proposition for Freud that they should read the Mills together. Now, Mills, not Mill. So at that point, she is assuming that Mill was a co-author with his wife, with Harriet Taylor, which isn't really far off the mark, because if you look at the Dedication to On Liberty, Mill says, "I owe the best of my work to my wife." And in fact, one work, The Enfranchisement of Women, was published under Mill's name, but was actually written by his wife, Harriet Taylor. It's published, Mill is open about it. He said he published it under his name to get it more publicity in the cause of the Enfranchisement of Women. And that, just incidentally, that Enfranchisement of Women essay was translated into German in 1879 by a certain Sigmund Freud. Now, Martha didn't know that at the time. She found out when the correspondence continued that he came clean on that. So you've got a whole sort of confusion here of readers, of literary characters and wives and writers. Now, Martha didn't see herself as a co-author with Freud, but she certainly saw herself as a co-reader. And reading is a sort of recreation of a work, so it's almost there. And that wasn't a one-off, this thing about reading the Mills. She says a little later on that she was enjoying, back to Dickens, Bleak House, and she was enjoying that enormously, and she knew that Freud had read it. And she said she'd love to read it with him, and he, you know, increase the pleasure on it by him pointing out the bits that he enjoyed and appreciated. So that's a nice image of marital harmony then. But again and again, you come from the harmonic to the demonic in this correspondence. So you have to switch back to these cyclical attacks that Freud has of doubt about her affection, dissatisfaction with her letters. Now you could speak simplistically, just pathology there, but every pathology emerges within social circumstances. And there's a letter of that shows it in a little while after that, in 23rd of June 1883, and he's speaking there, this is a very desperate letter on his part. He's speaking of his exhaustion in his daily life, of the battle he's involved in. He's an intern in the hospital at that point, but the sort of daily battles in the hospital that he's engaged in. And he talks about battling the Gesindel, the rabble. That's a nice recurrent term in Freud, Gesindel. And in this fight, he needs help, he needs support, he needs consolation, and she's not giving it. This is his accusation. At the same time, of course, we're talking of their consciousness, you know, the consciousness you impute to them. I mean, he's conscious that he's really pushing her, and he says, perhaps I'm doing you an injustice in all of this, and in that case, you should forgive him. This letter is responded a couple of days later by a letter from her on the 25th of June. So, you know, his desperate letters are followed by her desperate letters. So I'll quote from her response. The girl you ask to be loving and merciful and to comply to meet you halfway wants nothing else but that you should be happy and content with her. She cannot always say much. Not with her lips, and with her pen, nothing. There, my dearest, think more often of Cordelia. And when she has allowed a long time to pass, during which she has not told you or shown you that she loves you so much, then you keep forgetting it, and think that in the end, this is the most desperate thought for me, that you have thrown your love and tenderness away on someone who doesn't at all deserve to be preferred to science, and who in general doesn't deserve. But no, dearest, you can't think that. The tear that falls from my eye must not wet the page. You can't think that. So, this is passionate stuff. But if you start dissecting it, or vivisecting it, if you like, it's quite curious how she goes about it. I mean, she's going about it negatively, by denial, expressing her love by saying she's unable to express it. The Cordelia strategy, in fact. And not only that, but she's speaking the third person of herself. So she's, in a way, putting herself out there objectively, putting herself perhaps in his mind, from his point of view, and his thoughts of her. So you could say that all increases the pathos of it, or if you're going to be cynical, you can say it's pining on the enemy. But when you come to the tear at the end, you're just wondering if it should be her, not him, that's saying, isn't this like Dickens, my dear? Now, these marvellous editors of this edition, they're very meticulous in saying, you know, the form of the paper, and they don't actually say if there's any stains or smears on the paper, apparently not. But then again, she does say the tear shouldn't touch the paper. So, you can talk here of manipulating emotions, of her manipulating. Of course she is. I mean, what is a love letter but a manipulation of emotions? And manipulating isn't quite the right word, because it's a bit cold-blooded. I mean, this is hot-blooded manipulation, obviously, if it is scheming. And obviously she is in an unbalanced mood, and Freud was in an unbalanced mood, and Freud, of course, is contradicting his own strategy that she should write whatever she wants, you know, even if it is not, as he thinks, her emotions, that's fine. And there's something else to do with these letters. There's always different aspects of them, that both of these letters, his and her response, begin with a reference to Freud's hostile relationship with Marta's mother. Now, one of the reasons at this point why their nerves are on edge, both of them, is something to do with the mother. What was happening at that point is that they were right at the beginning of what they both knew would be a long separation. Now, I should explain that during the first year of this correspondence, they're both living in Vienna. So until June 82 to June 83, they're both living in Vienna. They can't see each other too much. He's working, or he's an intern. So there is a correspondence, but it isn't a daily correspondence at this period. And they're having meetings in between the letters. So, in fact, there's a lot of the love affair at that point is lost to history. In June 1883, Emmeline Bernays, Marta's mother, decides the family has to move away from Vienna back to their native town of Wandsbek, near Hamburg, which is the other end of the world as far as Vienna is concerned. So she moves in June 1883 to Wandsbek, taking her daughters with her. And this letter, these desperate letters, are just before, closely before what they know will be a long parting. And in fact, they don't get to, after that parting, they don't get to see each other for another 15 months or so. But there's a little blessing, the clouds and the silver linings. That means that in the second part, when she is in Hamburg, everything that happens between them happens on the page. So we readers are in the privileged position that we know everything about their love affair from the moment she leaves for Hamburg. Everything is conducted by mail. I said we know everything, but the question now is, do we really? Because this is a dialogue. Every dialogue has two points of view. There isn't an omniscient narrator. There isn't a single point of view that you can put yourself. You can try to. You can put you can imagine a hypothetical neutral point of view between the two. But it's not really reading it in that case. It's not properly reading it if you don't read it from both their single separate points of view. And there's another reason why you can't read this, you can't read these letters as a novel or even as an epistolary novel, because the old style epistolary novel, you always get a letter, response to that letter, a letter, response, so you've got a sequential narrative. Now what happens here is they start writing fast and furious. Now, they're writing much of that time one letter each a day. So the letters, which are in chronological sequence, do not follow. So if you want to read a letter and you want to read what it's a response to, you have to flick back over several letters to the letter it's responding to. Then when you're looking for the reply, you have to leapfrog over two or three more letters to find the response. And in between, there's all these other incidents going on. There's a sort of double narrative sequence, if anything. These narratives intertwine. They're each ring, each one is going round the other, twining round the other. So what you get is a sort of narrative double helix with all this overload of information, which is impossible to follow. Believe me, it's impossible to make a sequential narrative or read as a novel. Sometimes there are four or five letters between any letter and its response. What you need to understand it is some sort of emotional relativity theory. Now, this is before relativity, but it's not before Freud, and Freud has got his version of relativity. There's a nice letter quite soon after the beginning of the correspondence, and he writes, "The astronomers assert that the stars that we see flickering today began burning hundreds of thousands of years ago, and perhaps might be burning out at this very moment. So great is their distance from us, even for a ray of light that travels over 40,000 miles a second without tiring. This was always a difficult idea, but it has now been made easy for me when I think how you are smiling over my affectionate letter, while my soul at the same time is suffering doubts and cares, or how you are hurt by my hardness and suspicions, while a measure of tenderness is vainly struggling for expression, while a measure of tenderness that is vainly struggling for expression fills me." So you've got a little pre-relativity theory of the emotions here. There's a nice little touch in the notes to that. He wrote first, "When I see how you are smiling," and then he crossed that out and changed it to "when I think how you are smiling." So what you have here is perhaps part of the process of writing, when he's got a strong mental image, but when it's put on page, it fades to a concept. So in a way, that's how what happens when we're reading this. You get concepts, you get a feeling of this correspondence, but you can't form a strong mental image of it. As I said, the chronology just gets in the way of forming any clear narrative image of it. And this is not just a contingent difficulty, I think, and it's not a failure of the imagination. I think we're probably going the wrong way about it, even trying to construct a narrative out of this reading. Now, I'm talking about this now because each edition of these letters has a subtitle here. And these are all quotes, these subtitles. And the first one, "Sei mein wie ich mir denke," means "be mine as I imagine you." And it's a quote from one of his early letters. And we're told that the last volume will be entitled "To Have You as You Are." Now, there's a clear narrative implication in that sequence. So you're going from a sort of solipsist attitude of Freud trying to fantasy, he's made a fantasy figure of her, in fact, be mine as I imagine you. So this clearly implies that he's in love with a fantasy, and then you come to the end and I want you as you are. So this is making the whole correspondence into Bildungsroman or Education Sentimentale, you know, showing the development of the callow hero lost in fantasy to a mature figure who can see reality. Now, the trouble is you can't really read it that way. I can cite quotes from letters 7 years before the start of this with Silberstein, which show amazing maturity at the same time as he's an adolescent. And in fact, this last title, To Have You As You Are, which is a quote from a letter later on, is preempted within a couple of weeks of the correspondence in a letter of the 30th of June. It's only 2 weeks after they got engaged. And he says, whether I would like to take you as you are, no other way. I know of no other way. But more or less in the same words, he's saying, you know, I want you as you are. So this whole idea of constructing a novel, constructing a character, is a nonsense. I mean, it takes no account of simultaneity, of contradiction, of all, the whole of mental life. In fact, it's absurdly simplistic. And you have to say this because these letters will be used heavily by biographers in the future. And you can anticipate already how they will be used. They will be used in blame and casting blame and praise and all these sorts of narratives. And now whatever cruelty Freud does inflict, he's obviously inflicting it. And of course she is as well, both of them are. He isn't J. Cordy Jefferson. He's not the author of this affair. He is a victim of the plot. The plot is the relationship itself. And if we're talking about this as a plot now, there's a larger plot than these little narratives of praise and blame, is the relationship between the life and the ideas. And this, of course, is going to be another way this correspondence will be used by future historians and biographers. This is the Ur-Roman, the Ur-Freudian romance, you know, the beginning. And everybody will be saying, you know, well, not everybody, sorry, some certainly will be saying, will be asking how the life reflects on his theories of sexuality, and you're thinking of the dominance of masculinity in theoretical terms, you're thinking of penis envy, you're thinking of the nature of the libido, etc. So that will all be questioned by historians, and they'll be using this. So I have good reason for questioning this whole stratification of the letters, of reading it as narrative, as novel, etc. I mean, even Ernest Jones, who, as I said, was the only person with complete access to these, seems to have been taken aback by what he found in these letters, which is Freud's persistence and insistence on knowing Martha's mind and getting her round to his point of view. And in this chapter that I said is called Betrothal, Jones says, and I quote, at times it seemed as if his goal was fusion rather than union. Now, I've just been looking at translations of the Beyond the Pleasure Principle, and there's a sort of curious echo of that I've come across. I was looking at Strachey's translation of Beyond the Pleasure Principle. Now, Freud at one time is talking about the very origins of sexuality in protozoa, and how these primitive organisms propagate. And in German, Freud uses the term for the propagation of protozoa, he uses the term copulation, copulation. Now, Strachey evidently considered this to be a biological howler that the protozoa don't populate. And he translates it as conjugation. So this is an interesting point because it is a moot point in Freud's, in writing not just Beyond the Pleasure Principle, but writing these letters. he is concerned with the process of amalgamation, which is engagement and marriage, and whether it involves a matching of more or less identical organisms or of similar but unequal partners. Now, obviously, they've got a somewhat higher organism than a protozoa, yeah? But it's the same general conceptual problem of equality or non-equality. And both are, if you like, the facts of life. Now, in this correspondence, it's very much the facts of life that are in question. I mean, I'm talking about intercourse. I'm talking about intercourse in the good old-fashioned word of general cultural, social meeting, how you get on with someone. So here it's the motion, the emotional, the intellectual, the moral facts of life that are concern to both of them, Freud and Marta. What are the terms of their intercourse? How they negotiate it? Because there's always two sides to any negotiation. And as I say, Martha starts off unstable in our eyes because she's undocumented at the beginning, but you see her emerging as a character. The character, a woman in spite of the historians, and the historians, as I say, have written her out of history until now, and you can't blame them for that because they didn't have the documentation at hand. But even Ernest Jones, who was the only one who did have the documentation, did in effect write her out of history. In a chapter on Freud's marriage, he says of her, She deserved the psychoanalyst's ultimate compliment. She was normal. And that normal is in inverted commas. Now, that sounds to me very much like an evasion. I mean, you won't find normality in the Laplanche and Pontalis dictionary of psychoanalysis. I know it's entered the Anglo-American dictionaries, largely through the word of Anna Freud, but even when it's used there, it's presupposed that normality means a very precarious balance of emotional forces. So to have a dyed-in-the-wool Freudian like Ernest Jones using that, not just as a description but as a compliment, is very curious. I mean, it means either he couldn't make her out or he was too respectful to try. Now, one problem for Jones is he actually knew her. But he knew her as a middle-aged and an old woman. And here we have a very young woman, completely different character. And she's still, as you read, you can see, extremely uncertain of herself, even uncertain of her hold on life, of her own value. I mean, she said in one letter to Freud that she'd imagine dying young. This is the letter where she defends herself against his attack on her admirers, and where she sort of stamps her foot and says, but he will not eradicate friendship from her. And she goes on at that point to hint, well, more or less to say that if he's going to end the relationship, she might commit suicide. So something of that comes through, the violence of emotional forces there in her. Now, in Goethe's Faust, you have sort of weird, uncanny vision of the mothers, where Faust goes to meet the mothers, and their sort of primeval emotional forces. And in this correspondence, you've got the mothers, And they are really the primeval forces behind it. And above all, it's her mother, Emmeline Bernays, who is the moving spirit there, as far as the mothers are concerned, and the cause of these cyclical crises of confidence that he has. Freud's mother only really enters the picture as a means of comparison and of condemning Emmeline's, Bernays' behaviour, above all in taking her daughters away from Vienna, of course, which was the ultimate stroke of meanness as far as Freud was concerned. And not only Freud, his friend Ignaz Schoenberg, who was engaged to Minna, the sister. So 1 year after this bitter parting from Vienna and from Freud, she writes to him that her mother had noticed her crying, obviously because of this long separation. And Freud is indignant. He says, you know, this, a year later, she's only just as if she's only just noticed. And he writes, "My mother is physically and mentally an exhausted invalid, but I offer her my heartfelt apologies if I have neglected her. I know of no single action of hers where she has followed her own fancies and interests at the cost of the interests or happiness of any of her children. Fact is, you don't understand that. If there's any obstacle between us, it is this." So, what's going on there is not even Emmeline Bernays' it's not even Emmeline Bernays' selfishness per se that worries or concerns Freud. He can live with that. What's gnawing away at him is Martha's apparent attachment to her mother and her continued docile submission to her mother's will. And there's something even worse than that, which you find out as you go along. He begins detecting in Martha traces of her mother's character. So this is what he's fighting, what he called the Bernays spirit. So not so much he's not fighting the mother, he's fighting the mother's spirit in Martha. And that this is a lasting conflict, the Bernays spirit, and that goes on. And I could even trace it longer. I mean, there's a passage in Totem and Taboo about the figure of the mother-in-law, which should be read, of course, anthropologically. It's in theory of anthropology. But I can't help reading it biographically. I've seen the William Blake exhibition a couple of weeks ago in the Ashmolean, so I've still got fresh in my mind these Blakean images of mental fight, of spiritual battle, of projections, and I can see Freud engaged in this almighty spiritual battle against the Bernays spirits, or spirit. So that means they're what he detested, their ritual piety, the Jewish Orthodox spirit he's against, that tradition, their love of coziness and comfort, Gemütlichkeit und Behaglichkeit. He detests that. Their hypocrisy, as he saw it, their evasion of plain truths. So this is a spiritual, intellectual battle he's engaged with against the Bernays. And, of course, against any effect of their spirit on Martha. And this comes out, it's one of the pleasures of reading these letters, is that you see the character's own, the writer's own sort of self-images. There are projections in Blakean terms. And you get one which is 3 days after this letter about the mothers, comparison of the mothers. And I should have been giving you a few more pictures to rest your eyes on, actually, because there's, if this will go. I think I've got to unfreeze it, actually, because there is actually unfreeze. Let's see if it's unfrozen. I mean, don't worry, I'm not going to do a PowerPoint presentation. It's just that I had a picture of Freud on that day he wrote this letter. Let's see. Oh, that's nice. I'll be there. Ah, there we are. No, well, this is them anyway. This is a bit of the signs of, here we are. This is, again, signs, shadows, symbols. The signs of love, you know. Here we are. This is on the day he's actually writing this letter. And you can see she's quite mocking or funny about it, you know. Photographer's no artist. You don't always look. And she wrote this the day before she received the letter he was writing on the day that picture was taken, for you to understand his bitterness. So he's bitter, and this incidentally, this is her birthday, the 26th. This is a birthday gift, 26th of July 84. So the picture was a birthday gift, but it wasn't a bit of an ambivalent one, given his expression, given what he was writing that day. And coming back to this thing of projections, he wrote in this letter that he was writing that day, 2 years ago, a comparison occurred to me that I wrote to you about, of an invincible giant whose heart was a little bird perched in a distant cage. I think it was a Grimm's fairy tale. I think so, totally. And she goes on. That fits even more now than before. I am a giant, but fatally crippled when his distant heart is suffering. And the distant heart, of course, is mine, suffering in one speck. So this is quite a startling analogy. Obviously another bid for sympathy, if we're talking in these terms, but even as a stylistic ploy or a literary reference, it goes beyond the emotional function. The image sort of takes on a life of its own, like in the Blake. Now, earlier I quoted a letter where they're talking about reading Bleak House. That's at a period when they were writing every day to each other. But on that particular day that she was reading Bleak House, this was the 4th of October, 4th of October 1883, Freud didn't write that day because he was moving to a new room he was an intern in the hospital. He had a new room allotted to him in the hospital. And he made up for it the next day, on the 5th of October, by writing a long account of this move. And in fact, he draws a little plan of the new room for her, and it's reproduced in Jones's biography. And it's a sort of conceptual topography of the room. You've got the vegetative side and the animal side of the room, and the air and light side. And, it's quite very touching, nice picture. That's why Jones included it. And so he sent off this letter midday, and during the afternoon he got two letters came from her in one go, and he's so grateful to her for that he has to write another letter in the evening after this letter of the sketch. And he begins by expressing his delight at these two letters. And then he goes on, and here again we come, this will be the final analogy, and I'll end with this one. He comes to another of these projections or self-images, which is a sort of counterpart of the crippled giant he was writing about, and namely the golem. And he writes, "If you know the legend of the golem, who is made of clay and brought to life as soon as a piece of paper with sacred signs is placed under his tongue, and who returns to clay as soon as the piece of paper is taken away, then you could apply it to me, and you bring me to life with your sacred words of love." So there, finally, you have my title quote there, the sacred words of love. Now, what I like about this is we often talk about characters in fiction being brought to life. Now, what I love about this analogy is that it is the reader who is being brought to life by the writing. And I'm happy to take that as my model of how this correspondence should be read. And I'll finish off, if you'll let me, by giving you the golem. This is from a film, 1920 film, made called The Golem, by Paul Wegener, actually. And this is the golem who has just rescued the rabbi's daughter from it's a rabbi who gives him life, Rabbi Lerf of Prague. And he's obviously just rescued the rabbi's daughter. And if you like, here you've got the figure of the reading, and he's reading not a letter, but a woman. So again, a fitting image for this correspondence. So that's it. I don't know if I've overstayed my time, but anyway. Nowadays, usually from Vienna to Hamburg, regularly 2 days, sometimes 1.5 days. Sometimes, if they were lucky, you would get it on the next calendar day if you'd been posted in the morning. But regularly, they could count on 2 days there. Progress, it's called progress. So, between any letter and response, you've got 4 days. This is what he's going on about this theory of relativity. 4 days, when of course the mood has changed entirely and the other person is writing to a completely different character.
Yeah. Do we know, did Emmeline approve of the match?
She had to like it or lump it in the end. Now I haven't been in, I mean there are letters from her. They did get on in the end. I mean, they were a more illustrious family than the Freuds, of course, the Bernays, in one respect. Among Martha's uncles, there were 2 famous figures. There was Jakob Bernays and Michael Bernays, both very eminent academics. One of them, in fact, the originator of the study of catharsis, if you're talking about cathartic therapy. So they were more eminent family, so they were in a way going down in the world, she saw that. But on the other hand, her husband had been disgraced. He'd been involved in what was called culpable bankruptcy, so the family was a bit under a cloud. So they were equal in that respect, but now the main thing, they were both, not just Freud, but Schoenberg, the other fiancé, they were both penniless scholars. We're talking about tests, it's not only Freud that's testing, in a way she's testing him, he has to make a living, he has to prove himself, and that's common, you know, that is common, culturally common. The man has to prove himself as a breadwinner before he can marry. So, liking or disliking, I don't know, but she learned to live with it.
You said at the beginning that you weren't sure when you first came to work whether the letters still existed.
I didn't know at that point.
What did happen to them? Where have they? I mean, presumably they stayed in the family. I mean, what's the story?
They were in this house.
Yes.
Until Anna Freud had them sent to the Library of Congress. So they were in the Library of Congress at the time when the museum opened, and they were in, now I don't know if it was in the infamous Series Z, which is locked up and the key thrown away, or in Series B, which is locked up under long restriction. I mean, there may be somebody who knows better than I do. But anyway, they were severely restricted. They were in the Library of Congress and they were restricted. And as I say, after Ernest Jones, no biographer or historian had access to, certainly to Marta's side of it and to most of these, as far as I know, except any that sort of sneaked out undercover, which had, there were copies around. But the vast majority were hidden away under restriction, and so restricted that I wasn't sure where they were. But in fact, Anna Freud had made a sort of pact with Fischer Verlag that they should appear after, I think, about 2000. So there was always this agreement I didn't know about at the time that they were being edited and that they would appear. And finally, in 2011, they got the first. When we're going to get the next, and just before I came, I checked up on Fisher's page to see if there's any sign of volume 3 appearing. There isn't yet. So God knows when all 5 will be on the table.
Do you know if Freud's theories about mothers had already started being formed when he talked about mothers?
Well, you see them being formed on the page here. I mean, he's not writing psychology. This is the pre-psychological Freud. I mean, he's an anatomist at the time. But he's definitely theorized. I mean, all his letters, again, you can go back to the Silberstein letters 10 years earlier. I mean, he is a congenital theorist. You know, he always is thinking of this conceptual dimension when he's discussing things. So, as far as theories of femininity, as I say, you know, this correspondence will be used for this life and ideas crossover. Because you do see him, you know, the first fetal stages of ideas coming.
Sorry. The original German, any idea when they might be translated?
Well, I did notice, as I say, I looked on the site, that they've sold the foreign rights, get this, Spanish and Portuguese. These are the only foreign rights that have so far been sold, according to the page. So, they haven't even sold the rights for English. And from selling the rights to actually getting the translation, you're going to have years as well.
Yes. Just one brief comment there, Martha and Georgia.
Did they? Ah, new fact. You know, always new things coming up. That's a very curious one when you think about it.
Yes.
Jung connection in the family. Fifth column. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Right, well, what I should say, I mean, narrative is unavoidable. That's the way we think. We think in narratives. You can't avoid it. What I'm trying to say is there isn't a single narrative. There are narratives, and the question is degrees of importance of each one. I mean, maybe I'm thinking of some sort of free-floating attention, reading it in a way that you are reading the narrative and you're holding the other possibilities somewhere. You know, you're always aware of the... I mean, the thing is, I've just come from writing about photos, which are instantaneous. So, you know, you're looking at them on two levels, on the level of the instant and then the level of the whole historical sequence. So perhaps I'm thinking, still thinking in those terms, that you have to see them as they are at that moment of existence and see the narratives going through and round them and forming that instant. It's an ideal. I mean, you know, it's an ideal of reading. As I say, you can't not read narrative. You shouldn't read one narrative, or one overriding narrative even, as novels in the end will have one overriding one. So you should give equality to all the other narratives. And bracket the others off when you want to make a particular point, but holding them in mind. I'm an idealist, you know. Maybe. Pardon? Well, they're actually saying, you know, they are seeing themselves as narrative figures, and they're always comparing themselves to literary narrative figures, and, you know, it's something we do. They're reading all the time, they're reading thick and fast. There's dozens of doctoral theses waiting here, and one of them is the reading, the intertextuality of this correspondence.
I wanted to ask you, as somebody who's so familiar with Freud already, is there something in these stages that really surprised you or disrupted your view of Freud added to
the broad outline of what I've been talking about, these cycles of doubt, you knew about it. I mean, Jones knew about it and wrote about it. That's not a surprise, no. The surprise is in the detail. Is in the concrete effect, is in the multiplicity. And the surprise is Martha, actually, about actually seeing her behind this silent woman that she's been for, you know, the historiography so far. So, you know, these small surprises. It's a surprise reading, you know. The specificity of it, you know, it's when you come down to this level of detail, following their life day to day, you know, that is in all a surprise. That level, I mean, there's few historical figures that are documented at that level, and in fact, you can't incorporate that into any biography. So one of the things I've come away with that this publication will make nonsense of any future biography, because they've written the biography there of these years, and that can't be surpassed. So any biography after that is going to be a cartoon version, a sketch. That was Ernest Jones. Yeah, I was quoting Ernest Jones. Yeah.
I'm thinking of the correspondence in the 90s with Fleece.
Yeah.
Where Freud obviously expressed a huge intense need for fusion. And I was wondering if also towards a woman who might express a similar...
Yes, he does, but it's a double binder. And he knows he's in a double bind. Because one from one point of view, I mean, this is common, you want that other person to share your views, to share your feelings. So he definitely wants that. And to the point where, as Joan says, it's lots like wanting fusion. At the same time, he absolutely needs her to be his reality checkpoint. He needs her to be real, to be other. So he's in a double bind there. And as I say, he knows it himself. He wants her to be herself. And, he wants her to be grieved and be, you know, his support, emotional.
It's like an impossible situation.
It is, yeah, you know, that's love.
Final question. I wanted to find that was extraordinary. I mean, just the complexities of their letter writing, which is basically, but also just making you think about how difficult it is to interpret any relationship through letters and the nuances and the different ways of reading and the different views that each of the participants had about what was actually happening. It was extraordinary, thank you. And I should have said at the beginning as well, and it's frozen, that Michael just alluded to his most recent book, Looking Through Freud's Photos, which is, but again, you know, from having heard this, you will understand the kind of the depth of the analysis that Michael makes in there of particular photographs is extraordinary and enlightening. So thank you very much for tonight and the reflections on this correspondence. And we'll have to get you back when that next volume is finally issued, and the one after. And you could please translate into English for us when we finish writing the song. So thank you.